Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. This will be going up on a podcast, so we're recording it. I'm excited to have this one here today. I'm just looking at our podcast video with the curtains up. Looks like we're doing a hostage video. Is there any plea for help you'd like to blink to the audience?
Man, just please review.
All right, so T.J. Relk was raised on a dairy farm in Idaho. With severe hay fever, lactose issues, and a curiosity for the world, he decided agriculture was not in his future and joined the Army. He collected intelligence on East Germany's military until it fell apart. So he wrote his first draft of his book instead. That was in 1991. In between, Joe was almost fired from Pizza Hut, developed his own major at Boise State, hosted a cable access TV show, explained road projects to irate motorists, and reported for a variety of media, including NPR Reporter in Idaho. With that introduction to diplomacy, Joe joined the Foreign Service and served in Germany, several American posts, Hawaii, and Afghanistan, where he met his wife. Is it Elaine?
Elaine.
Well, Elaine's very close to being in the right place here. That's excellent. They put together a photo book about their experiences during Afghanistan through the Humvee window. Since retiring as a Foreign Service officer in 2022, Joe worked short global migration and speech writing gigs and finally finished his book. He and Elaine live in Burke, Virginia with their four boys, two humans and two felines. So please welcome T.J. Relk. So he's going to do a short reading at the beginning to give you a little feel for his voice. And then we just kind of let these things grow organically. I got a lot of questions for you. I'm really interested in this. Before we get started, I just want to ask you, how long did this book take you to write? Because you mentioned writing your book. Was that the prequel that you were writing in 1991 or this one?
It was book one. The original book is book one, Escape from the Calling Box. That's the one that I started in 1991. When I was a soldier preparing to deploy for Gulf War I. We never went, but a lot of the angst and anxiety of that is sort of fed into that story. And I rediscovered it about 10 years ago in my mom's basement. Read through it, and I was like, man, this is really bad writing. But the idea, the concept is really good and more timely now than it was when I wrote it. So I started to rewrite it from scratch, and I got up in the morning at 5 a.m. for a few years to rewrite it from scratch. I did not look at the original draft until last night at about midnight. And, I think I made the right choice by rewriting it from scratch. So, that would be the, book one. The prequel is originally going to be a freebie to generate interest in book one, but people liked it and wanted more, so I turned it into a novella. And that's from the perspective of the protagonist's sister who is on the home front. So if you want to know, if you're reading the main book and you want to know what's going on the home front, that gives you the background. Or you can just wait for book two, which hopefully next month.
See, you know, you mentioned that it was such bad writing. Isn't it amazing when you write something, how you just grow during the process of writing and you look back at anything? Like when this latest one, when you finished it and went back to edit, did you notice you were a better writer than when you started?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I've learned to spell. I guess maybe thanks to spell check. It's quite different. I will say there are a few parts of the thing I wrote when I was 19 or 20 that I thought were pretty good. So if I do a remake, I may pull a few more things back into it if I do a second edition.
Well, they say it takes a million words to really develop your craft to get that level of mastery. So yeah. You're on your way for sure. So how long did this latest one take you to write?
I would say it took me maybe an hour a day for 3 years to rewrite it. And then book two, maybe an additional year for that. So, you know, these have all been written for years now. So I'm not the quickest tool in the shed, but I'm happy to get all this finally done and out. And I hope you all enjoy it.
Well, I don't think people realize like how hard it is to actually get a book out. Like we all read, right? So you read, and you're like, how hard could that be? But you're seeing a final product. And that all the labor and the time and the other things you're not doing, right, the lost time, When you finally got this book out and it's published and you open that box and you first look at it, how does that feel? I'm always, because this is your debut fiction.
Yeah, I feel like it's done. It's out there. It's finally accomplished. And, you know, doing that hour or two in the morning before the boys get up was crucial to doing that. So if there's if I have mistakenly typed somewhere in there, like, Alex put the cereal away, then that's what that's all about.
I love it. So why don't you read us a little bit so that people can get a little feel for it. Just give us a short reading here.
Well, for those of you that haven't read it yet, it's a dystopian, but it's also it's a more speculative fiction, near future thought experiment. So it's where I believed in 1991 where trends might take us, and I think it's more prescient now. And it's about authoritarianism and how it creeps in. The prequel is written from the perspective of the sister of the protagonist, so it tells you more about what's going on the home front. And I thought it might maybe strike a chord with some folks here. So this comes after the sister is wanting to push back, I guess, against the slide into authoritarianism, and she's conflicted, and she's late. She feels like she waited too long to get in the game. And I think a lot of people do. You know, one of the questions I try to raise in the book is, how do you know if you're in a dystopia, do you know that you're in a dystopia? So that's sort of the mindset that she's in. So this is her, after some of her friends are taken away, and trying to decide whether she should participate in a protest. I was afraid for Gloria and my other dissident friends. I wasn't a leader, but I was still afraid for myself. What had she gotten me into? I smothered those personal concerns to focus on the protest, the same protest Gloria was trying to publicize for the following morning. It might be our last chance to put the world back in order while it could still be saved. I owed it to Gloria to at least show up. Spread by word of mouth, I was surprised at the large crowd. At least 4,000 brave souls gathered at the Seattle courthouse. I was late enough that I was only at the edge of the group when hundreds of police charged in, asserting those on the periphery as they peeled away layers to get to the protest nucleus. Electrons like me, still circling around ambiguously beyond the demonstration's edge, had a choice to make. Move toward the protest core and get arrested, or pretend to be bystanders and go home. I chose the latter. I survived. I never heard from my friends in the protest again. That night, it was on the news. As a press conference, President Wolf said it was a reminder of how enemy misinformation can mobilize radicals against their own government. Not one critical question. No one spoke up for us.
And you mentioned dystopia and people not knowing if they're in it or not. How do you define dystopia?
So dystopia, yeah. So I mean, this is the bad world that comes. I think about Orwell and I think about Huxley and the worlds that they presented, the world building that they did to present a state that was oppressive, a state that stripped people of their rights, a state that only identified people through their function and their role supporting the government, right? I mean, Orwell did that in as used pain as the motivator for people to go along with authoritarianism and with state oppression. And Huxley used pleasure. In my book, and I only read the Huxley book after I wrote my books.
Oh, interesting.
But I found that my book sort of said, you know, my central operating principle here is, why can't you do both? You can, and you know, you can rule through fear and you can rule through pleasure, right? I think it's Orwell that said, the state will keep you from reading and try to forcibly make you ignorant. And Huxley's opinion was more along the lines of the state will create a situation where you don't even want to read, right? So that's and you can do both at the same time.
So what drew you to that theme? Well, you said you wrote this back in 1991. Was there something going on at the time that led you to this? Or you said you were working with East Germany. Like what personally made you want to write about this in a fictitious world?
I think the fact that I was slated to be deployed to Gulf War I. And I was an intelligence officer, but I was a young intelligence officer. So I remember sitting on top of the armored personnel carrier and going through the Iraqi military's inventory and finding a piece of artillery that we made. And my first thought was, how did they get this? Did they capture it from an enemy? Was it inherited from a prior regime? And then, of course, I found that we gave it to them. And I just found it a little perverse that I could be sent to a conflict where I would perhaps be on the firing line of equipment that we had provided, right? So I think that made me gave me an angsty feeling that maybe elites were trying to control the destiny of people and put them into wars not of their making, and that kind of made me feel a little bit like I was trapped in that situation, and trying to reconcile those things was all going around in my head. And I think that's where the original script came from.
So I mean, that definitely is shades of 1984, right? Like our enemies, our friends, weren't we just fighting them, right? Like that kind of, had you read that prior to the deployment?
1984, yes, I had. Actually, I have the 1984 edition of 1984, and it left an impression. I think the other thing that left an impression for me was my mom went through World War II in Nazi Germany, and we had a lot of other friends that lived under Nazi Germany, so I was raised on a lot of those stories, state oppression, controlling the narrative of the truth and what the truth is, and using war as a motivator to manipulate the masses and solidify elite control and that sort of thing. So I think that was all sort of the basis for this.
So a lot of people like come to theme after a book, they'll write it, they'll have a story, and then they'll realize it's about something. But it sounds like you're sort of the inverse of that. You wanted to write about something and you brought your plot along to help. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And, you know, I mean, why do people write dystopian novels? I think a lot of people are trying to warn you that there's things that could happen. Where is all this technology taking us? Where is AI taking us? Resource scarcity, environmental collapse, all these challenges that we're facing. And the central core of the book is really, can we trust people to self-govern? Right? Can we come up with a solution? And in my scenario, elites do not wait for that. They see existential threats and they take action and they change the world order in such a way that they can solve the world's problems.
Why don't you just give us a little like back jacket copy? What is this book about without giving away the ending?
I think that's it. Like if you're So this was kind of by accident, but the book starts in 2028 with the 2028 election. So a lot of this is new, right? So the core of the book, someone being sent to a forever war where he's not supposed to come back and comes back, that's pretty consistent with the vision of the book and as originally conceived in 1991. But of course, I rewrote the book 10 years ago and started rewriting it. And so a lot of more current themes have seeped into it. AI, of course, didn't exist in 1991. A lot of the political polarization that we have right now was not where it is right now. Social media wasn't a thing. These are all sort of dealt with in the book as facilitators for authoritarianism and a slide into dystopia, right? So that's sort of at the core of the book and the journey of the soldier that escapes from the forever war. And is, you know, for is not really the hero of the book, because he comes back to a place that is a utopia, right? So this is where you have most of the population lives in a utopian situation. Only the people that get sent to the Forever War are living in the dystopian future, right? And to them, he's not a hero. To them, the people that save the planet from existential collapse are the heroes. So in that way, the book is a little different than a typical dystopian novel. And it doesn't really, I don't want to give away the end of the book.
But, don't do that.
But there's this tension, right, between making decisions on behalf of the population to save the population for the greater good, but against their will, right? So that's the conundrum that he finds himself in. And his very existence coming back from the war he wasn't supposed to return to provides a foothold for people that want to reintroduce free will and want to reintroduce some form of democratic governments, right? That's the dilemma, right? If the elites have managed to hold on to power and taken power, abused power in order to save society, and that threat passes, then they have no more excuse to maintain that system, right? So he gives people that are change agents in the elite an opportunity to roll back the dystopia, right? So a lot of this book, particularly the prequel, deals with the transition to dystopia, how we get there, and then the book itself deals with how we might get out.
So you've covered, I mean, it covers a lot of subgenre, right? Like you're saying dystopia, that's even a spectrum of fiction, you know, from near future, what you've written here, to real sci-fi. And so you sort of have a techno component to this as well. Were you aware when you're writing about like the tropes and the reader expectations for these various like subgenres, or were you just telling the story and you kind of let the chips fall where they may?
You're teaching me about the subgenres right now. So no, it was a story that I thought it, you know, I thought it was a story worth telling. And I know other people have done it better. I don't pretend to have written as well as Orwell or Huxley. But I thought that what my story brought to it was modernizing it and putting it in a modern context that readers today might be more able to digest and understand. And, of course, they didn't have AI when Brave New World came out or when 1984 came out either, right? So I'm hoping that, you know, people can identify the themes in those books through my narrative and my story.
I'm always curious how writers come to like the plots themselves, right? You have the theme, you have the points you want to make and the warning but you have to write it in a narrative that's interesting and that has some pace to it, right? That keeps people's attention. So was the actual plot based on anything in real life? Or do you remember the like germ of the original plot idea, not the theme behind it, or where did this come from?
So this is going to sound, a little, New Agey, but it was a series of dreams I had when I was a soldier in 1991. So I imagined that I was being sent to a forever war and that it was contrived and world leaders, orchestrated this constant warfare in order to, one, control the population and, two, cull the population, right? So that was the germ right there. And then book two, which I only wrote an outline for in 1991, is very different. That is new. I originally envisioned book two would have been a very short book because it's just a basic rebel, trying to raise people's a rebellion and failing. So that's not where book two goes this time. Book two goes, elites are also torn, right? Do they want to be benevolent and allow free will back into society? Or have they found a formula where people are ostensibly happy, their needs are met, and the threats that were existential have been overcome? So that's the tension between the elites that, that will be fleshed out in book two, between those who want to change the status quo, which for all intents and purposes has worked out for most of the population, except the people that are sent to the forever war. Or do they want to maintain that prosperity, that peace, or do they want to reintroduce free will into the people?
I love the political and philosophical aspects of it. It's really interesting, right? But I'm not going to let the dream thing go. So go back to that. Have you dreamt stories before, or was this the first time it happened to you?
No, I feel like there's
a story here.
People are, familiar with lucid dreaming. So this was a series of dreams I had over a series of nights. I would wake up, I'd write them down. My roommate would be like, "What are you doing?" And that's sort of the original book, and that does trace pretty closely to book one. Book two is a lot more modern narratives and take off from there. And like I said, if I had gone with the original outline for book two, it'd be short and depressing. And I've heard that book one is dark enough. So I want to let people know that if they get through book one and they, haven't had to seek psychological help, that book two, there is a ray of hope there.
You know, maybe keep that out of your marketing messaging, just a suggestion for you. So, it's really interesting how the subconscious works, right? Because, I've had, story plot ideas or whatever, and you wake up in the morning with the answer. I mean, what is your subconscious doing, and does it still work like that, and is that still an integral part of your writing now?
Well, outside of this book and finishing this book, I haven't done a lot of fiction writing. I did a nonfiction photo book with my co-author about 10 years ago. And I've written a lot of stuff when I was younger, but I have kids, Jeffrey. So I don't do a lot of for fun writing, and this was this was the project that I thought had the most promise and that I thought had the most to say about where we're at today, and themes and threats that we should always be cognizant of. So going back to Orwell and Huxley, I had hoped to revisit those things in a way that people would find more accessible and would be more relevant to their modern life.
So was this a one-off for you where you had to get this out to the world, or do you have the fiction bug now and you keep going?
Well, I'm waiting for MGM or Paramount to call for the movie deal. And if that works out, then I would shift to full-time author. I mean, it is what I love to do. I would love just to write fiction, nonfiction, you name it. I have more story ideas than I know what to do with. And then if I go back through my old files in my mom's basement, I'll probably find some more, right? So that would be the aspiration. But for now, I'm focused on this book and getting it out. I think it has the most to say to the present condition that we're in.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. What's your protagonist's name?
David.
Tell us about David, but first, tell us how you created David. Is this a lot of you and David, or is it based on people you know, or is it just made out of whole cloth?
Well, it's a lot of me. It's based on a dream that I had, right? It's based on, I would say, book one is, again, follows pretty faithfully the original script from 1991. Book two, I have given my readers, basically put all my angst and anxieties into book one to share with them. So we've talked about the different things. It's about forever wars. It's about AI. It's about technology. It's about resource scarcity. But it's also about things like family. It's about, how do we treat the aging? If we could be immortal, would we want to be? What's our obligation, our loyalty to our family, to our friends, and to ourselves, and how do we balance that? And that's something that the protagonist has to struggle with, partially because his family thinks he's dead and won't accept him. So, you know, there's for anyone who's been away for a long time and come back home and not recognized home, it deals with that whole notion of can you come home again? Or is home just something, you know, what is home? Is it the imaginary place that we have in our mind? And this is what motivates the protagonist to escape after all those years, right?
How much did you deal with that, right? Because you have the image of home when you leave, and you're gone for an extended period of time, but life goes on and everything changes, and then you come back. How did you deal with that in your own life?
Yeah, still dealing with that. And, you know, I think that was, you know, the lesson to myself, is that you can't expect people not to move on. You can't expect, to leave, you know, so, you know, I see one, you know, some of my colleagues from the State Department here too. So you leave to represent the country. And then the country you represent, you come back and it's quite different. Right. So that takes some getting used to. I feel like I should ask them how that's all worked out, for them. So, I mean, I think part of this is me working out my inability to accept that things change, and home changes and family changes and friends change. And that's certainly, something the protagonist deals with in a much more advanced, accelerated way, because all he has are memories for, you know, I don't want to give it all away, but for a very extended time. So this is what sort of tethers him to his mission and his reality and his desire to escape. He is motivated to get back to this place that really only exists in his head at this point. So getting back there, he has to deal with the changes, and how he deals with that is mostly in book two.
So you're reinterpreting Huxley in Orwell, and you're trying to have a modern version of this to get these kind of warnings out, these threats that never go away, right? It's part of the human condition. But how much of it is you, as you say, working through this, right, for yourself? Because a lot of writers do that, and I think people don't realize in fiction how much people put of themselves in these books, right? So if you had to put a percentage on it, how much of this is you working through these issues for yourself versus how much of this altruistic, let's get a warning out to the world?
Can it be 100% of both? This has been a cathartic book for me to write, right? On a lot of levels, and particularly the newer stuff, because if you read the end of book one and book two and the prequel especially, you'll find some themes that are coming up. I mean, I did write this to start in 2028. It's based on a lot of trends, you know, in all the subjects that we've already discussed, AI, resource scarcity, forever wars, all this stuff. So this is sort of trying to answer how we would deal with that, and deal with political polarization, and how we might solve that, or how elites might solve that for us. But I have those, you know, the trends have been there for decades, right? But the turning points that I lay out in the book aren't supposed to start until 2028. But I think if you read the prequel, you'll find some of that is already sort of underway.
So when you're picking 2028, did you worry that it's so close in the future that when people look at it, like in 2029, for example, they might not look at it? Was it necessary to put a date on this? And what did that bring to this? Because you want to keep it in the near future, right? So the political situation was similar to what it is, and the technology was similar, right? So you didn't want to go too far away. Am I right in that assumption?
Well, one of the things I found is in the original book, it was an 8-year timeline. So it would have been over 20 years ago, right? So I think we've allowed a lot of the original concerns that I had 30 years ago, 40 years ago, to fester and get worse. And you know, and this is why when I picked it up, I was like, you know, this is actually more true now than it was back then. So I do kind of feel like we're at an inflection point. 2028, I originally didn't have dates in here. Book one is mostly in 2076, you know, so it projects that far out. And the prequel is, I picked 2057. Are the dates arbitrary? Yeah, to an extent. But I also thought, you know, I guess 6-7 years ago, where I thought these things would percolate would be 2028. Mm-hmm. You can read more about it in the prequel, but I thought people would just get tired of the partisanship and would long for someone who would just fix it. And that's why I have a billionaire tech guy who comes in with no political baggage, who sweeps that up, right? And self-financed. So that's, you know, that was a guess on my part. It's probably going to be wrong. But you know, 1984 was written about 1984. So, I threw out 2028, put my, line in the sand, and just kind of have to live with it.
I love that. So how much, like when we were talking about the character, right, and your protagonist, how much of a dystopian novel like this, especially something that has these strong themes of philosophy and politics, right, how much of this is character-driven versus plot?
Character-driven versus plot. So I've tried to illustrate these things through the character. So he's discovering a lot of, you know, he is left in the dark. He's a loser in this society, right? He's been sent to the Forever War. He's not supposed to come back. Nobody's supposed to come back from the Forever War. That's how we cull the population. That's how we do medical experiments and science experiments and how we keep the population motivated and in line. So that's the purpose of the Forever War, right? So he gets out of it, and then he's introduced to why he was there, and what's happened in the world since he's been gone, because he's been in an information vacuum for decades. So when he comes back and tries to unravel this, it's unraveled through his eyes. So I did get one. I got some very nice editorial reviews. One of them noted that I don't tell you what's going on. You know, that you have to discover it as the character discovers it, which he said that particular reviewer liked that approach, but it requires some patience.
And how much does the character change in this without giving away endings? But do you plan out, like, character arc? Or is this something that, as you go, you're just seeing how your character reacts in various scenes? Like, there's always character change, right? Was that planned in advance?
The character, you know, in the original vision of this in 1991 was pretty static. You know, he found some things out. He didn't like them. He rebelled against them. Now the character undergoes some more growth. The new concept does not have this split between the elites that he's able to get into. So, you know, he's motivated to return home because of what he remembers and the person he remembers himself to be. And then when he gets home and it's not there anymore, and he finds out all the things that he's fought for are untrue, and based on lies, then he sort of has a rediscovery of himself. And that's, you start to see that, I think, at the end of book one, but it's more developed in book two. Book two, you know, we're exploring, we're in dystopia. How do we get out of dystopia, right? And that requires society is required to redefine itself. That's the central question, is can we trust ourselves again with free will and some form of informed democratic government, right? And he's rediscovering himself at the same time. So there's a parallel track. Society is questioning itself and evolving, and he's doing the same thing. And he's trying to figure out whether there's a place for him to fit in anymore in the new world.
Well, I mean, those are the best books, right? When you have the internal and external and the arcs are somehow merging together or following parallel as they are with yours. To what extent do you think readers, when they're reading fiction about these types of philosophical ideas, are better able to accept something, especially in like a really divided country, like because they can take themselves out of the present and the reality and put themselves in this fictional world? Do you think your ideas are able to maybe penetrate a little better in that environment?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that people can identify. You know, I think we've all had, disappointed by expectations we've had about friends, family, society, the world. And this is sort of about him coming to terms with it and trying to find a way forward, right? Or does he give up? I mean, that's an option, right? So that's the struggle that he goes through. And I think a lot of the struggles that he goes through, we all go through, just on a different scale. So I'm hoping that people can identify with the protagonist enough to walk through his path with
him. So you've been in some interesting places in your real life. To what extent does location and setting affect your book and your plot and your character development?
And other people in the room have also. A lot of my friends have also traveled in a lot of different countries and a lot of different places. I think seeing how other societies function or dysfunction, how other governments oppress people, how other people are pulled into one, to a greater or lesser extent to some of the what I would consider distractions to public discourse. I think that helps, and also to identify the commonalities, right?
So, I mean, obviously this book's very personal. You've put in a lot of time for it. You mentioned now you'd love to do this full time if it were even possible. When do you first remember a story captivating you like this? You've talked about Huxley and Orwell, but like go back further. Like when was it that, because I'm always curious, are storytellers, made, or are they born? And when did it first really attract you in any kind of story?
Well, I was just watching Paramount last night and rediscovering some of the old Twilight Zone episodes, which are brilliantly written and hold up today. And I was also, I always had this, we talk about struggles within the family. One of my struggles was, Star Trek was on at the same time as Gunsmoke, and I always wanted to watch Star Trek, and the rest of the family always wanted to watch Gunsmoke. And the argument was always like, Star Trek's not realistic. It's just made up baloney. And I was like, do you think a guy could walk down the middle of an old west town shooting from the hip, and no one hits him, but he hits everyone else? At least in Star Trek, the guy in the red shirt dies once in a while, right? So, I was the youngest and lost the argument most of the time.
So is this, you always had this appreciation for like sci-fi, and is that what you read as well?
I as a youth and even more recently, I like Philip K. Dick, Martian Chronicles, Ray Bradbury. I've always enjoyed those kind of books, that sort of take you out of context and use other worlds, other times, to illustrate important themes, right? So those are two of my favorites.
Your covers are really good. Who did your covers?
Mibblard.
Yeah.
And Shannon knows this, but I paid them to do two covers, and I liked them both. And I asked the Boy Scout troop to decide, and they had a split decision. So I used them both. So I used the first cover in the prequel, and the second cover for the regular books.
So is there another one coming out with these characters, or what's next?
So book two has been written. I have an editor in New Zealand who's given me her final chop on it. It's just a matter of me going through and finalizing it and formatting it, setting it up. I want to publish book one as an ebook first after I get sufficient reviews. And see how that goes, and then I'll publish book two, and If it's a bestseller, then I'll do a book three.
And if it's not, will you just write something else? Will you continue to write? I guess that's what I'm asking. Right. You know, I mean, it's a tough business, right? 3 million books mm-hmm. coming out a year. It's hard to break out. You've done it. You've got the process down. Will you keep writing?
I think I will. Book two has an ending. It's a hard ending, but it begs a lot of questions about where society would go and where the main character would go in the future that I would like to explore.
And, okay, I love it. I'm going to go to the audience now. If anybody has questions, I'll come around with the microphone and so we can get it on the podcast. We've got one over there.
I'm fascinated. Totally fascinated. I think this is so prescient. It's stunning to me that 30 years ago you saw what was happening today. So those dreams, maybe they're new age, maybe from God, I don't know, but they're amazing. I'm curious about your family. I come from the Midwest. Did grow up on a farm. I like to say I did because it's more interesting. We had a farm, but I didn't grow up there. But anyway, my family doesn't necessarily appreciate, you know, the writing thing. And I'm just curious, what do they think? Do they think you're kind of out there, or do they think it's cool or different, or yeah?
I think they're ambivalent. Is that right? I don't think they're tracking. I mean, they know that I put out a book. They know that it's probably not about agriculture, fishing, and hunting. So I'm not sure, you know, how interested they are. And that's fine. Everyone has different interests. I guess I'm the black sheep of the family in that no one else in the family shares my interests or hobbies. But I hope they read it. And if they do, I hope they give it a review.
Yeah. Other questions? Here you go.
You mentioned getting this out on MGM or some other movie producers.
I was going to say Paramount, but not anymore.
Who plays the role of David? I love the book. I read it. And I have my own answer, but I need to hear who you have in that role.
David, I'm looking for somebody that could play the role of kind of a withered veteran from a faraway war who comes back, you know, to the world. And it would be a bonus if his name was David. So maybe you. Pedro.
So you originally came up with the idea in 1991, and publishing is so much different with the digital revolution, and et cetera. Compared to back then to now, I know you've rewritten it, with self-publishing and digital thing. Do you feel like now is a time where, you know, an independent writer can break out on their own and get some interest in more of the, you know, kind of circumvent the maybe smaller group of, you know, Hollywood and publishing industry? Like, do you think this is like the perfect time to, you know, break out and get yourself heard as an independent author?
Well, I think it's liberating for a lot of people that they, you know, you can invest your time, and that's really it. You know, we remember back when if you didn't get a publisher, you were done. That was it. And then you would have never had books like The Martian, right? It was a self-published book. Did I get 50 Shades of Grey? It was a self-published book.
It is self-published, yeah. He put it out on a blog and then had feedback and then self-published it and then got picked up.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some great self-published books out there. There's a guy over there, David Wessel, has a great self-published
book. Hey, Joe. He has
a publisher, actually. But there's a lot of good independent, you know, authors that are doing things and have more avenues. I think maybe the flip side, and I'd be curious to see, you know, hear what you have to say about this, Jeffrey, but The downside to liberating everyone to write is that the market is flooded with writers and books and product.
They're not all good.
and they're not all good. I mean, it's liberating, I think, for people to be able to do this, particularly for things like family histories, right? I think the flip side of it is there's a lot of product out there. And back to your point, I mean, back in the days, it's all gatekeepers, right? They tell you if your book is good or not. They tell you if it gets published, gets picked up, gets turned into a movie deal. This provides a way around all that. But the odds are still pretty stacked against an independent author breaking out. And if you're again, Jeffrey knows far more about this than I do, but it's not just the book or the quality of the book. It's your ability to get it in front of readers, right, and get them to buy it. And I'm not great at marketing, right? So maybe I can get a little help in the future. But that's the things a publisher would do for you. You know, they would do your cover. They would assign you an editor. They would take all that work out of it that I put into it and that independent authors have to put into it and do all that for you. The flip side is, you know, you have to tailor your product to what they want, right? So you lose some creative freedom. And if they don't like you, you're done.
Joe, do you think having spent some time as a speechwriter and that helped you be able to write more naturalistic dialogue?
I mean, the book wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for my speech writing chops and my mentor, Randy, who helped me along the way. To put these concepts into an engaging dialogue, you know, that people don't just hear, they remember.
Your questions on this side? Anybody's? This is your chance. He has to answer you. Any other questions?
Real quick. Yeah, you mentioned quite a few authors, science fiction, Orwell, Bradbury, et cetera. But one of the things I appreciated about your book, books I read too, and was mentioned by one of the reviewers was that there is the subtext. But there are you don't tell people what to think. You give a story. And then there's layers underneath that, which when I read it, I immediately thought of Heinlein. And so, which back in the day, you know, we didn't use dystopian to describe Heinlein's books. You know, that was the old science fiction. So I was just curious, he was a great story. You could read his stories. It'd be fun on one level, action and everything. But there were many levels beneath it that were comments on society. So I was just curious, were you ever a fan? And
no, but I'll definitely check that out. I would say that part of the reason I wrote this book is because I struggle with the same questions that I'm posing in the book, right? Free will, is mankind be trusted to self-govern and with dominion over the earth, right? So, and I don't want to answer the, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that. This is along the lines of the dystopian oppressors in this book. You will get a sense that they're not all evil, right? So people had to make hard decisions in this book, and they are lauded as saviors for doing what they did. But that doesn't mean what they did wasn't evil or wrong, or that we lost our humanity somewhere along the way, right? Which is also important, or should be. So it's a lot about, you know, it's a lot about, and you'll see this in book two more. What do we value? What is our life worth living for? Is it prosperity, or are there values that we also, and when they conflict, what wins? So I mean, these are questions that I struggle with, and so now I'm opening all my struggles and anxieties to readers so that they can share my angst.
Thank you for giving me a second. This is one for you, Jeff, because we're hearing from a lot of people here. I know we've got a lot of writers in the room, and a lot of them are saying, do I self-publish? Do I, you know, and I know your advice is get a publisher. And I hear from you, and I'm with the same boat where it's like, I don't want to wait 20 years. I'll be dead. And you tell me it's 1 in 4,000 chances of getting an agent. So what is your advice?
It just depends on the situation. I mean, you can certainly try, but there's a lot of people who are very successful self-publishing too. It's just, it's 3 million books a year that are coming out. All right. Any last question? Okay. So you have books for sale up here. Where, for the people who are watching on the podcast, where should they find you?
So you can go to Amazon for hard copy books and ebooks. You can also, I published on Drafted Digital, so it's on Barnes and Nobles. The hardcover books you can find pretty much anywhere. And the ebook for book one should come out as soon as I get 10 or more reviews.
And you have your book open. Do you want to read something else for us?
I read from the prequel, and this book is about launching book one. So I thought I'd just end with a bit of what's going on in what I call the calling box, which is where the great powers send the unfortunate ones to fight in the forever war. The decision-making process for his troops was devoid of individual reflection. During combat ops, authoritative guidance manifested itself almost exclusively from the ICOM, the communicative wristband Goliath simultaneously piped into their ocular implants. When it malfunctioned or was severed from the body, soldiers froze in place. If you saw a soldier standing motionless as fighting raged around them, they were no longer online. David used to try to assist these vulnerable comrades, yelling in vain for them to get down or return to base. They would usually just stare at him. "Shut up," one snapped at him, explaining curtly that she was waiting for the next op word, blood pouring out of her severed arm. They were not quite symbiotic with their mechanical implants yet. Their faces and voices betrayed a hint of existential human fear. Fear of death, yes, but perhaps more so, the crushing panic of losing contact with their technological hive's guidance. They would never receive that crate for next order and invariably be struck down in battle. David had stopped risking his life for them long ago. Free from the ICOM band and ocular implants, referred to as clear vision, David reckoned he was off the controller's virtual map. He was counting on that to escape detection.
Oh, that's great. Love it. So, Joe, congratulations on your book. I have two requests for the audience. If you would just go on Amazon and rate him, leave a short couple-sentence review. It makes a huge, huge difference. And also, if you like what we're doing with our literary salon, please go on to Open Table or Yelp or wherever you rate restaurants and give us a rating. We'd really appreciate it. Congratulations, and thank you so much.